So, for your entertainment this evening, I've the talk that I'm going to bounce on you is the development of wisdom in day-to-day life. And the vast majority of us, you know, regardless of one's background, have an interest in deep and profound understanding, in insight, knowledge, regardless of whether, you know, we're Buddhist, Christian, Hindu. There's always a component factor there, an insight faculty to increase our depth and understanding of both ourselves and life in general. And within the Buddhist framework, we put quite a lot of emphasis on this, because the wisdom component, essentially, it affects many of the underlying factors of this particular path. And so when we actually look, in an overview format at the Buddhist system, that you can basically narrow it down to, say, three major categories, you know, both with the sila or morality, and the samadhi or the meditation component, and then the wisdom component, the genuine wisdom component, which actually brings you to the realization of truth, or the ultimate nature of both yourself and the universe. So, for the vast majority of us, you know, with our day-to-day experience, you know, how do we actually develop wisdom into our day-to-day experience? You know, how does wisdom actually manifest in your actions, your thoughts, your feelings? And with the vast majority of us, that wisdom essentially requires mindfulness, it requires attention. You know, you need to have a basic awareness of what you are actually doing on a moment-to-moment basis, because, you know, without awareness, there's no real knowledge or understanding of what you're actually doing with this body and mind of ours. And so the mindfulness, when you look at the, you know, without getting overly complicated, you need to start with, say, with mindfulness as a causal factor. And as you develop, you know, that mindfulness, that attentiveness within your moment-to-moment experience, you develop, a greater sense of, focus, or, intellectual sharpness to a degree. You know, basic mindfulness, that ability to, you know, retrain your attention in one's general everyday experience, you know, just keeping one's eyes on what one is doing, and for example, when you're with people, to actually focus on that one person, not to be lost. Say, you know, if you're in a room full of people, and then getting lost in distraction, or possibly things like multitasking, where you're constantly splitting your attention or the quality of your awareness. It's going to essentially, it does weaken mindfulness to a degree. It could have small degrees. Some people who have very, very fast minds, you know, can multitask and still apply mindfulness in a moment-to-moment basis without great difficulty. But for for mainstream people, to get good results in this area, they need to just to have that gentle focus, that attentiveness, you know, throughout the throughout their conscious hours of the day and evening. And one little method that I've used previously, which works quite well and allows you to essentially to run, to function at full intellectual capability, and where you're not, you know, your awareness, peripheral awareness, and your memory is not unduly, say, compromised. Because the vast majority of us, we may be very interested in meditation, but you need to be sharp. For example, if I'm at the top of the line, I myself can't afford to make too many mistakes. And if you're in business, you're running a company, or you're an executive, or you could be, like a registered nurse on intensive care. Or in the emergency department, you've got to be, the mind needs to be sharp, fast, and you really need to know, to have full awareness and know what you're doing. So that ability to retrain attention, where you develop this underlying, say, tranquility and peacefulness of mind, clarity of mind, and that gives you the ability to investigate, to see things more sharply, more accurately, without your excessive thinking or proliferation or very, very, say, strong feelings, strong emotions actually clouding your personal experience. Because with the vast majority of us, when your personality is very, very very, very strong, in the conscious level of the mind, that it may essentially cloud your ability to see things clearly. If you have very, very strong personal views and opinions, that is going to interfere with what's actually coming into the mind, the sensory input, through the ear, eye, nose, tongue, through the body, through sensations. You won't necessarily be able to even get, a handle on the truth of your experience. And with many of us, that this is the reason it's necessary to develop deep and profound meditation as the years go by, in order to really get that deep penetration of the reality of one's experience. And occasionally people say to me, they feel that they're in touch with reality and they're in touch with the truth of their experience, but in reality that's not the case at all. The vast majority of us, our personal experience is coloured and distorted by your personality, by your personal biases, your views, opinions, your likes, dislikes, your loves, your hates. It's going to colour what's actually coming into the mind, and it's going to distort and bend things. And this is why we have this emphasis on very, very, very sharp mindfulness and very deep tranquility within formal meditation, to actually get the depth and the clarity to see things very objectively and very, very, very clearly. So, with this whole principle of that first category of, say, sila or moral development. How does a person develop wisdom within the parameters of morality? How do we conduct ourselves in a wise way? Within a moral framework, and many of you will understand that the person who has it's not a judgment. For example, people who have have a substance abuse, or may be incarcerated for, it could be a single offence or a number of offences, or they are prone to antisocial behaviour, which brings them into conflict with other people. Potentially could bring them into conflict with the law. That particular individual, they essentially they're not guarding themselves. They're not protecting themselves with say with sila or moral guidelines. And naturally, the vast majority of us don't expect people to be saints and to conduct themselves in this kind of manner. But we don't really have any choice. We have to keep our the sila, the one's moral integrity, within certain limits, because once you overstep those limits and overstep the boundaries, there's going to be friction, problems, and difficulties are very likely, to arise, because you can be like disturbing the sensibilities of the people around you, your friends and companions, the people you work with, your partners and children. They may not necessarily approve of someone who may feel that they can do what they like at any time. So the this principle of sila is essentially you're keeping your personal behavior, your thoughts, your speech, your bodily behavior within, an acceptable format, and your behavior is acceptable by social values, by social norms. So the naturally, sila has to be, in order for people to actually say keep, even things like the Buddha's five precepts or the Ten Commandments within the Christian fraternity, that they need to have that that underlying understanding, that awareness that it's good to be a good person, and because I mix with drug users, and I mix with prisoners and different classes of people, like I mix with rich and poor and people, from different social classes. But these principles, they still cut the ice right across the range, regardless of where you come from, because these particular principles, they are truth principles. Morality is a truth principle, and it's for people who have good sila, that essentially they're very easy to live with. They're the kind of people who make friends without difficulty. They are people who don't create problems and friction within their personal relationships and within the general community. So for anyone who's even able to keep the five Buddhist precepts, that person automatically has a minimum degree of, say, wisdom or understanding. Otherwise they just wouldn't bother. They may feel that being a good person, not necessarily a goody two shoes, but being a good person is doesn't really have any kind of intrinsic value. But the vast majority of you will see very clearly. The vast majority of you have internet access, and it's absolutely obvious. People who overstep the boundaries, essentially they create problems for themselves and other people. So if we move on to the second major area of the development of meditation, which is going to be, say, the causal basis for the wisdom faculty to arise. Every single one of us, we need a minimum level of mindfulness, a minimum level of, say, samadhi or stillness of mind, in order to get the say the clarity and the sharpness, the awareness, which gives you a more clear perspective on your personal experience. So, with people in general, we tend to think a lot. You know, we tend to think far too much, and with this, you know, excessive thinking or proliferation, you know, you're looking at a refraction of your mental energies, and so for people who want to say like maximize the mental capabilities, to maximize their personal energy, essentially you really need to focus on, if you can really focus on one thing at a time, you know, if you have the time, the energy, the ability to do that. So mindfulness training, you need to develop that to be successful with meditation in general. So mindfulness is that, as I mentioned, that that attentiveness on a moment-to-moment basis, moment-to-moment awareness, regardless of what you're doing in day-to-day life. And that mindfulness, it increases your focus, your mental energy, which you can direct into the formal meditation practice. So the sharper your mindfulness is, you can essentially transfer that into formal meditation practice, into walking, into sitting, into the loving kindness meditation. And you know, an obvious example was when I do the Armadale group on a regular basis, that you know, one particular person there, you know, felt that their meditation really wasn't that crash hot. But when, after you know, maybe 5-10 minutes, when I actually looked at the expression on the face of this person, who largely does the loving kindness meditation, you know, this person had a huge, you know, grin on their face, and they were, you know, you could see that they really had, you know, the happy vibes. And you know, this is a person who really loves this practice. You know, they love the warmth, you know, the fuzziness, the good vibrations, the loving feelings, and the positivity and the inner joy. They really love this practice. And it's, you know, it is very useful in itself, you know, for, and this is the reason why I always recommend at least a little bit, especially for regular meditators, a little bit of metta or compassion for oneself, at least, you know, for say 60 seconds, and you know, before every sit or walking meditation. And even 60 seconds will give you enough energy in the mind, enough positivity, enough joy to maximize the quality of both the sitting and the walking meditation when you do your formal practice. So the way it works is, when, as some of you are aware, that when you do loving kindness, when you do compassion for oneself, you know, loving kindness is based in generating feelings of goodwill for oneself, and you can do this, you know, in 100 different ways. You just change the formulation, the words that you actually use. You know, you choose the kind of feeling you want to radiate towards oneself. And you know, you can mix and match. You can change that every minute, every 5 minutes. But the intrinsic point is that it's based in goodwill. You know, I'm radiating a sense of goodwill or positivity towards oneself. And and naturally, with the compassion meditation, one is aiming at relieving feelings of discomfort, pain, sorrow, and like unease in a general sense. And and that particular formulation is, may I be free from. Now that's the emphasis, free from any particular, say, worry, concern, or mental or physical affliction. And you do have the ability on the mind level to even to heal oneself of, say, emotional difficulties, you know, as past traumas. And it could be like real worries and concerns. So for example, a person who suffers from, say, paranoid schizophrenia, and I've seen this for a fact, you know, with several people, that when they generate a particular emotional quality, either based in loving kindness or compassion, which is aimed at directly relieving feelings of paranoia, persecution, anxiety, fear, mistrust. You know, you do these two practices very specifically to help balance the mind and bring the mind into a state of emotional balance or ease. You know, this kind of especially for people who are compromised by say, like, thought disorders or mental illness. I know a handful of people who are able to see good results with this practice, at least to a surface level, a superficial level, which allows them to function and interact with other people without becoming overly worried or concerned, or being tormented by spirits or demons. At least in the smallest case, it takes the edge off the difficult feelings they have to deal with on the level of the mind. So within the meditation process, how do you apply a meditation? How do you apply the wisdom faculty to developing and increasing the quality of one's personal practice? And many of you have been long-term meditators, and this is something I always put emphasis on, whether I'm doing the meditation classes or formal teaching, that is to maximize the skillfulness within the quality of your practice that you're developing. And so, for example, the main practices with the breath meditation and walking meditation
could be loving kindness.
That I always place this emphasis on increasing the paying attention to the characteristics of the meditation. As it could be like 5 minutes, it could be 30 minutes, it could be a full hour on a daily basis. And even over the space of 5 minutes, if a person is accustomed to this kind of practice and does this on a regular basis, they could be doing this maybe even twice a day or whatever. That just by paying attention, making slight adjustments with the practice, so for example, with the breath meditation, adjusting the location in the physical body, or whether they do, say, like 60 seconds of loving kindness, compassion beforehand, and then they do 4 minutes of formal practice on the breath, and or whether they use a simple meditation mantra with the breath meditation, and or whether they switch, they go from the breath to contemplation, within, say, the space of several minutes. They get some kind of obstruction, some kind of hindrance, which doesn't allow the mind to settle down. They're still thinking too much. There's something that they are attached to, and they just can't let it go. So, this is something I always recommend for people, is you just don't use force or pressure with the practice, with the walking, sitting, or any other kind of meditation objects that you which is suitable for your character. But the, you know, once you, you know, one, you know, if you're thinking too much, just automatically switch to the wisdom practice and actually, you know, see what's blocking you. You know, what am I thinking about? Why am I thinking of that particular individual? I'm maybe having particular strong emotions or attachments, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, just try to look at it very clearly and look at it from a full 360 degree perspective. Because if you don't look at these things, if you don't address these things thoroughly, you know, and you may have to do this 1,000 times over the space of, you know, 10 or 20 years, you know, this mental phenomena, this emotional phenomena, it's not going to go away. It's going to keep coming back again and again and again. And, you know, it's like it's knocking on the door of your mind and it's telling you that it needs to be addressed. And, you know, there's I always recommend for people, if they don't, you know, if you don't settle down, if you're not satisfied with that meditation easily within the space of 30 minutes, you know, you just switch to the wisdom faculty, you know, after 5 minutes, and you see what's blocking you and look at it very, very closely, look at it comprehensively in full detail in a very relaxed way, and watch the mind very, very closely. Because when you do this, the vast majority of the time the mind will settle down. You know, it can be a complete waste of time for people to constantly put forth effort, putting effort with attention, and the mind doesn't settle. You know, you just don't waste any time. You just switch to the wisdom faculty and explore your experience, and then usually you see the results quite quickly. And for many of you, you may just have to switch, maybe every couple of minutes, maybe every 5 minutes, switching from the object, from the breath to investigation, to the breath, to the investigation. And, you know, because my attitude is not to, like, waste too much time, you know. Most of you people are working full-time or part-time. You know, may have partners and children. And,
you know, you really need to maximise
the quality of your practice as the weeks and the months go by. So if you're looking at the long term, you know, so the results of wisdom, you know, arising within the meditation practice as a cause, you know, for deep wisdom, you know, for penetrated wisdom later on, is, you know, you're getting, you know, good results with the meditation. You know, you're satisfied with the meditation, you feel a sense of, say, ease and contentment with the practice. You know, you feel that you're not wasting your time. You know, you're just gradually getting results step by step. The mind has a greater sense of, say, patience and tolerance. And, you know, possibly even without formal loving kindness and compassion or sympathetic joy, that you're actually seeing these emotional qualities arise in the mind over time. And, you know, this is a natural condition that even without actually putting emphasis in these specific areas, because you can generate specific emotional qualities as you choose with the practice, that you know, you will see these more deeper emotional qualities just arising strictly from anapanasati and from walking. And the reason this actually takes place is because you're refining the mind down. You're increasing the awareness, the sharpness of the mind. You're increasing your wisdom faculty through investigation, and it increases your quality, your faculties as a human being. So instead of being a nasty or brutal individual, you know, which, you know, I've come across in the past, that when this person starts to meditate after about, usually takes about 6 months or a year. They start to become a fairly decent human being, even if they've got a potential for, you know, like, you know, basically violence against other people. You know, maybe some of the prisoners in Carnet or Caserina have got a potential for antisocial behaviour or interpersonal violence. After about a year of daily meditation, they start to become like nice people. And, so with the wisdom faculty are manifesting, so you actually see on the level of the mind an increase in personal qualities, patience, tolerance, and, you know, just general good characteristics, positivity, inner happiness, you know, freedom from, say, anger, irritation, many of the sort of garden variety negative feelings that most of us will go through, the vast majority of us will go through in the practice, because essentially this is the testing ground, because, you know, you're actually seeing into one's nature, one's character. You're actually bringing these things up into the practice and putting them to the test, so to speak. You're bringing them up into awareness, and then you've got to start to work with them. So the naturally, you know, over time, you know, one sees a gradual reshaping
of the qualities
of one's character, and naturally supported by the meditation, that one's wisdom faculty will gradually progress, you know, from the beginners to the hopefully the intermediates level after maybe 20 or 30 years, which may be, you know, like quite a realistic perspective, because, you know, with the Buddhist spiritual path, it's not a let's see, I wouldn't call it if you've got, say, like incredible personal, you know, development and faculties, you know, you could fast track, you know, you could essentially become enlightened in this very life, which, you know, would be a very realistic proposition. And those kind of people are the people who have, say, on the minimum level, they have upachara samadhi as a basis within meditation, suppression of the thinking process, the major obstacles, thoughts, you know, you need to really like tranquilize your thoughts and feelings to quite a major degree, and in order to get that very clear, still, so you say penetration, in the insight, knowledge into one's personal phenomena. So as time goes by, so for the vast majority of individuals, you know, the people who have that level of meditation, the upachara samadhi, with the suppression of the five mental hindrances, those five major thought patterns, and then you get the incredibles, you know, what you would consider to be very profound stillness of mind. You know, if you're talking about really good meditation, if, you know, you've got to really believe, you know, really feel that meditation is quite profound. It's not like, you know, average meditation, you know, regular meditation. It's really, really still. And it's very, very sharp and energetic. And so, with the development of the wisdom faculty, that you can you can investigate the most. I always encourage people to investigate, you know, in their, say, like their day to day experience. Even the most, you know, most shallow, trivial things are well worth investigating, even if you've seen them 100 times previously, because it's a law within the mind, that when you actually investigate, you know, your personal experience, investigate mental and physical phenomena, that you increase mental energy within the mind. This is something you actually see. And people who develop these, say, like a skill in investigation, you usually find that there's actually an elevation in mood, an elevation at least to a small degree in joy or positivity, because the seven enlightenment factors, the first two, the development of mindfulness, number two, investigation of personal experience or dhammas, and then number three is the energy component, is basically set rolling and becomes active. So, you know, people who like to investigate a lot, they tend to see an increase in mental energy, which as it increases, and say increases in strength, becomes like rapturous feeling both in the body and in the mind, that you experience as a weak level to full, you know, like if you're talking like really, really strong rapture, both in meditation or as a spiritual experience, you know, you're looking at, you know, like full body rapture. You know, some people might equate it to, you know, say like the opening of the kundalini, the really, really strong feelings of energy within the kundalini system, and moving through the whole body from top to, you know, from top to bottom, you know, even for like easily minimum 2-3 hours, up to 5 hours at a stretch. And, you know, it's quite interesting, because some people might think, how can you possibly sustain incredibly strong rapture like for 5 hours? But, you know, this is like mind phenomena. And when you open your mind, when you tranquilize the mind and you let go at that level, you know, you open the channels in the mind, you open the currents in the mind, and then you just get this energy which flows through you. And I had one monk tell me, he was meditating, he had a practice of I'd say like meditating right to the point that he would drop off to sleep. And this is something I'd always recommend for all of you, is when you go to sleep at night, just follow the breathing, the breathing meditation, right to the point you drop off. And the reasons I recommend this is you not only get more restful, more deep restful sleep when you go from a meditative state into the sleep state, because you're inducing tranquility, you're inducing stability of mind, you're quietening the thought process, which many people find disturbing. One of the reasons you can't go to sleep straight away is because essentially you're thinking too much, and it's your feelings. You know, when you have like strong emotions, that's what drives your thinking process. When you're basically a cool customer, when you're emotionally cool, you usually find the thinking process is cool. The thought processes, don't become excessive. So you develop that as a skill every evening, you know, just before you go to sleep. You know, it could be 5-10 minutes. For some people, they may take a full hour before they drop off. But follow that breath right up to the point that you lose consciousness, and the quality of the sleep will be deeper. You will actually go into the sleep state more deeply. The sleep will be more of a greater quality and more restful. And so, for example, if you're incredibly busy, where you've only got time to sleep maybe 5 or 6 hours a day, that you will find that just even sleeping for 5 hours, that you can still be racing around and doing this and that, you're working full time, and you'll still be able to cope with your day-to-day responsibilities because the quality of the sleep, it's at a deeper level. And so the as we look over time, you know, as the months and the years go by, you know, we increase the quality of the investigation, you know, both it can be absolutely anything. It can be even within nature, you know, natural principles, where, you know, even little things like, say, like ants crawling on the ground, you know, the bees buzzing around the flowers, you know. I mean, don't ever think, you know, things like this are really shallow and trivial. You know, I always, even when I'm at the kuti, I always, you know, I'm always watching the little birds. And unfortunately, I don't have any little bunny rabbits to watch anymore because, you know, I think some nasty little predators has eaten them all. But I had a small bunny rabbit which used to, he wasn't fully grown, but he was so, he felt so safe in my presence that he would just like lay down on the clay and watch me walk meditation maybe say like twice a week on a regular basis when he was around. But unfortunately, he's disappeared. So I think, you know, with any luck, you usually find that because we've got, you know, we've got one cat in the monastery, and you've got feral cats in the surrounding forest, that essentially the rabbit population, I mean, I can't even remember the last time I saw a rabbit. I think they've been knocked off just so quickly over the years. But the young ones get taken first because they don't have any real sense of danger or awareness. The adults are much, much sharper. So, but that that wisdom faculty, just watching, just things in nature, you know, the way the wind blows and the way things grow and the colour of species of different plants and flowers, and you know, it's well worth actually looking at these things. And because when you look at the investigation of one's personal phenomena, you will see like similar what's the right words, characteristics between different categories of dhammas. You know, for some, you know, some things that you look at, you investigate, they have similar characteristics to other things that you look at. You know, and you can connect. It's like when you investigate dhamma, investigate personal experience, that it's like you're putting together a very, very large jigsaw puzzle, and you're putting things together piece by piece. So for example, you're working down, you know, you've got a jigsaw puzzle as large as a wall section. You know, you're there with your, you know, you pick up your little pieces, and you know, you pop them in a corner, and you know, you're searching around, and you know, you're looking at different, you know, different things, different pieces, and then, you know, you see things which have, you know, similar things in common, and then you put them together, you know, you experiment, you put them together, you see that things match. So say for example, you get maybe 3, 4, 5 pieces of the puzzle in a very, very small corner. You know, you're putting things together, and then as the pieces go together, you start to see more and more of the big picture. So, you know, starting with 1, 2 pieces, you can't see anything. You know, once you get about 4 or 5 pieces together, then things start to take shape. You start to see some form. You start to see maybe some kind of, it could be a characteristic. It could be things like, pebbles, you know, like, you know, something like, you say, like pebbles on a beach, or maybe it could be like a bee buzzing around a flower. You know, you get 5 or 6 pieces of the jigsaw together, you can see, you know, see a little bee buzzing around a flower, and so you're starting to catch on, you know, what this is about. You know, as you explore things, as you, you know, putting the pieces together, you're starting to see more and more of the big picture. And so that's what this business is about. You know, as we explore, we investigate, our thoughts, our feelings, and our personal relationships with other people, and the things that we see in nature, that we're slowly, slowly, as the months and the years go by, putting the pieces together. And, you know, over the course of, you know, say 20 or 30 or 40 years, that eventually, you know, you're going to you're going to become wise people, hopefully. I'd imagine most of you will. So, you know, but this principle of wisdom, you know, you know a wise person from a silly person just by the way they live their life. You know, like silly people, they do things which you may not approve of, which, you know, which maybe the police don't approve of, you know, government authorities don't approve of. They do things which give rise to trouble and difficulties both for themselves and for others. And that's when you look at a person and that's what differentiates, say for example in the Buddha's teaching, that's what differentiates the wise person from the fool, so to speak. And I'm not implicating that anyone's a foolish person. You know, I think most of you are pretty smart. You're on the ball, otherwise you wouldn't be here. So, unfortunately, some of my friends in Carnet Prison or Casarina were quite, you know, they're quite sharp people. They're pretty smart people, but they, you know, they just made maybe one or two small mistakes which put them away for 5, 10, 15 years. So, but as one of the guys said the other day, because we usually got two or three guys who work in the monastery, and they just, you know, some of these, many of the prisons I know within the meditation group, they are really decent human beings, but they just made maybe one or two, you know, quite significant mistakes which got them incarcerated. And but, you know, you might find, maybe, you know, from what I see, I mean, you know, I don't know the rest of the fraternity there at Carnet, but there's plenty of decent people there. But you know, essentially, they might have been compromised. You know, they might have tried to make quick money, and you know, this type of thing. They, you know, there was a degree of moral, infraction, leading to incarceration. But so essentially, you know, you see the difference there between the wise person, the silly person. But you know, you can get like people who have, they could be compromised. You know, they may be quite moral people, but they could be under pressure. They could be very close to losing their house, and they make decisions which they wouldn't usually make. You know, they could be in a very, very tricky situation. They could have a partner, young children. They could lose their job. Money's incredibly tight, and you know, got guys up at the a Carnet, you know, who, you know, I mean, you can make, you know, easily, you could make like $10,000 a week, you know, like cooking methamphetamine. I had one lady tell me about a couple of weeks back that her partner was making like $1 million every 12 to 18 months, you know, like cooking meth. So, you know, the temptation is there to make incredible money, but, you know, but the risks, you know, when you have got the ability to make big money in a short space of time, that the risks tend to be in the same category as well, both on within the legal and illegal framework. So when we look at the span of our life, the development of wisdom, you know, we're moving from the small picture, you know, one's small little world, you know, as the years go by, you know, one develops like, you know, like, say like the big mind, you know, say like the, like, similar analogies is the Zen, the big mind that you find that they talk about, so within the Zen analogy. And you know, increasing sense of spaciousness, understanding, and sharpness—the sharpness of the wisdom faculty—increasing knowledge, and insight, regardless of what you look at. Because especially with investigation, with Dhamma, things are interconnected. They're linked, like the internet. And, you know, you have the, as you increase your skills in this area, you have this ability to actually link your, like, snippets of wisdom that you actually develop in different areas. And if one chooses a particular category that one is interested in, like it could be wildlife, that you can actually sharpen your skills and faculties in that area just through observation of biology, like flowers and fauna. And those insights that you develop in that category, that you will be able to link with other areas, in other categories of investigation. So when we look at the big picture and the course of our life, that, you know, the essentially what the Buddha said, that wisdom shines in behavior. And naturally, you know, the vast majority of us, we're not perfect human beings. You know, we deal with our underlying personality, our nature. And we have very, very strong feelings, and you know, we have our thinking process that we have to deal with. But essentially, you know, wisdom shines in behavior. You know, of body. You know, speech, and the mind element, one's thinking process. And essentially, if you're talking about really profound wisdom, you're looking at the full course of a lifespan, or maybe a succession of lives for the full realization of enlightenment, the kind of wisdom which actually breaks through to the spiritual path at its highest level and gives you the highest realization into Dhamma, the highest realization into the nature of this body, this mind, and the universe as we know it. So I'll wrap it up there, and I'll just open the floor to maybe some provocative questions or challenging statements. I will take on all comers. Are there any takers? There's a gentleman there with a beard.
You mentioned about using the breath meditation up until sleep. Mm-hmm. Was there a danger that you could make an association so that when you go to meditate in daily practice, that you then want to go to sleep?
It's possible, but it depends on the level of mental energy. Most people, you know, just in a general sense, when people develop the skill of using meditation to induce, you know, to ease their path into the sleep state, to maximize the quality of the sleep, they're usually able to separate it. So, for example, the person develops this skill of meditating up to the point that they lose consciousness, the point they drop off, but it doesn't mean that person is going to get sleepy on the cushion. You know, if a person gets sleepy on the cushion, you've got to look at what's happening there. Maybe the mental energy is low, or they're genuinely tired. Things like, you know, if you start to fall asleep with the breath, you may have to energize the mind, maybe with some kind of mantra, long form mantra formulation, where you see the mind slip straight away. So if you use like a long form mantra, as soon as you lose mindfulness, you know, you spot it within 1 or 2 seconds. You know, it's immediate, and you know, mantras are energizing. You're forcing the mind to think, to work. So you know, if you're dozy on the cushion, you can do a long-form mantra with the breath meditation. It's not difficult. It's just a skill with all practices. So as you're breathing in and out, wherever you like to locate in the body with the breath, that you do the long-form mantra. You could do something like the Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato, or you could use the Om Mani Padme Hum, and do it very relaxed, very slowly. and to essentially to solidify the breath, to reinforce the breath, and you know, your mindfulness doesn't slip, you know, very, very easily. There's lots of little tricks you can do to maintain sharpness on the cushion. When you're walking, it's not that difficult. You know, most people don't fall asleep when they're walking. You know, you must be incredible if you can fall asleep when you're walking. But you know, I did hear one meditation master whose meditation was so deep and so fast, he would actually go into deep samadhi on the walking path. And sometimes he would bump into trees. You know, this is actually a true story. He would be moving incredibly slowly, and then he would induce a deep state of samadhi. And sometimes he would take an extra couple of steps, and then he might possibly trip over a stone, or maybe you know even bump into a tree or a plant. You know, this is what was said about this particular individual. So he just had to adjust his practice, you know, keep the mind working, so his mind wouldn't go too deep. But very, you know, had very, very fast meditation, fast samadhi. So you know, you can make adjustments, and it's like, you know, developing skill. This gentleman there.
You talked earlier about switching from the breathing meditation to the wisdom meditation when thoughts arise, so that you could examine them. And you talked about a sort of 360-degree examination. Obviously, there's a danger that by concentrating on a thought, you just get caught up in it again. So I just wondered if you could explain a little bit about examining thoughts in that way.
Yeah, there's a couple of approaches that you can use. I mean, that was mentioned in the Armadale group. One, it depends on your character, what actually works for you. There's a couple of approaches. So, for example, you're thinking too much. This is only what I do, which works for me. You know, I've been in the monastery 20 years, so I've got a handle on this. That I go to investigation, and then I try to get a 360-degree perspective. I try to understand fully what I'm going through, so there's no stone unturned. And then I just go straight back to the breath, and I just keep shifting every couple of minutes. This is only the way I increase the quality of the practice over 10, 20, 30 minutes or so. At least, but for some people, they may just find just labeling is enough. If they feel that investigation gets them caught up and too involved, they might find that just like labeling. So, for example, you think of maybe Bob, some business deal with a fellow called Bob. Then you just label Bob, just his name. And so, for example, you think about you having some nice meal. Maybe you're going to a restaurant later on this evening. Restaurant. So you just use these very basic labeling terms, and some people find that effective. They can label and identify, but they've got a bit of space and detachment. They're not getting too caught up with it. I just label it and then I drop it. This is what this particular lady said. For me, it's just not effective enough. But for her, it worked. So you know, if you're still thinking too much, use long form mantra with breathing and walking. With some people, just even watching the thinking process, because it can be so crazy, it becomes very obvious to you quite quickly that this is just like madness. You know, if your mind is just constantly spinning and it just won't shut up, within five, you watch that for 5 minutes and it's very clear to you, this is just really, it's a bit insane. It just won't stop. And it will actually provoke, and it will force insight. You'll see it clearly. And some people can actually use that to settle down. They may use it initially, 5-10 minutes, and they switch to the breath in whatever format that they choose. Little tricks like I find quite good is standing meditation. You have your feet maybe 12 inches apart, and then focus on the soles of the feet. One sole or two soles of the feet. And what happens is you're focusing on feeling. You're not focusing on thinking. So you get grounded on feeling. And because you're moving away from the cerebral level, you're dropping it right down to the ground level, moving from high to low. You're pulling away from this thinking process, which is usually higher up on the level of the head section, that most people experience. And, you know, that's just another little method. So there's all sorts of little tricks. But essentially, you've got to see what works for you. You know, you experiment and you see what works and you use that tool for as long as it works. And when it doesn't give good results, then you switch to something else. You know, because meditation, you constantly have to keep adjusting to get good results. Was there anyone else? Okay, question one, Leo from the Netherlands. Can you explain how wisdom will help if two people have conflicts and have different views? So, say for example, I had conflict with one of the monks in the monastery, which usually doesn't happen very often because I'm such an easygoing senior monk. I only let people do whatever they like, maybe half the time. So for example, if I was in conflict with one of the other monks, the first thing I do is to look very, very closely at what's going on, and you go straight to feeling. Don't get lost in excessive thinking and proliferation. The action is where the emotion is. And that gives you a very, very clear perspective on what the problem is between you and that other individual. So look at the feelings very closely. It could be a single feeling. It could be two or three different emotions. Zero in on that and then examine that very, very closely so you get a full understanding. Because as I mentioned, this is just one approach, the more you investigate that emotion, the more you understand it, the easier it is for you to let it go. Things are hard to let go when you don't know what's going on, when you can't see what's going on, when things are hidden from you. This is why I always keep pushing this business with you know, just examining, reflecting in a very gentle way. You know, you don't have to play psychologist or psychotherapist. We're just looking very gently. You know, we're probing, we're examining. We're just reflecting back and forth to gain some understanding. This is all to your welfare and benefit. You know, we're trying to increase one's wisdom component. So that's the first thing I do, and. You know, so for example, over the space of maybe a couple of weeks, if I can't settle that difference I have with that individual, you know, there's all sorts of different tricks you can do. If investigation doesn't cut the ice, if you think it's not effective, then do things like you can do equanimity, the equanimity practice. This particular person is the owner of their karma. You know, this person is the owner of their actions, their behaviour, and I get a little bit detachment, you know, with this attitude. Or I can use this kind of attitude that this person is empty in nature, you know, like you know, this could be like the person. Say for example, the person's name is Harold. You know, Harold. Use this mental formulation as a meditation or with a breath. Harold is empty in nature. You know, might sound quite funny, but you're starting to look at this person. They're empty in nature. They're not really important. They have no real substance. They don't really count. They're not important to you in your life. You do this for like minimum 20, 30 minutes, and then bring this person up in your mind, and you will actually see. You'll start to cool off. You know, maybe just a small degree if things are really bad. You know, maybe several hours. You know, easily you'll see it, and you know, you bring the person up, you put it to the test. You know, how do I feel about this troublesome individual? And you'll see a cooling of emotion because I'm getting some space, I'm getting some distance. This person is not in my face. You know, they're getting there's more more space, and you know, I'm starting to cool off with this individual. You can do things like if I've really got hatred and anger, if I really can't stand them, you know, it's a good thing to do, say like loving kindness, compassion for them. You make it strong. You always start with yourself because this is where the problem is. You radiate love and compassion for yourself. Maybe if you want to test it for 5 minutes, see how you feel. Look at it after 5 minutes, see how you feel within yourself. and then do it for that individual. You know, sometimes you've got to love yourself even before you can love other people. This is like a truth principle. So, and then you go to the person that you don't like, and then watch the feeling. You know, meditation is very much a feely path. This is where you really learn, and then look at the quality of the emotion, and see if you can see a difference. So you're looking at a number of meditations, a number of perceptions of ways of looking at this individual. At the back, yes, is it Eddie? I'm not sure. I can't see clearly. Eddie. Is it a quick one? I jumped the gun. Give me 5 minutes. Yeah, you've probably got something deep and profound. All right, question two. Hadish from Toronto. When living alone for many, many years and literally no one to give you love and compassion, how can one generate feelings of love and compassion by themselves during meditation? So naturally, that same principle again, whatever feelings you want to generate for yourself, the loving kindness meditation, may I be happy, joyful, positive, may I be wise, skillful, may I love and respect myself completely. You know, all of you know what kind of words are important for you. May I be such and such. That's loving kindness. Radiate that feeling continually with sustained attention. Do the mantra in a very relaxed way, just very gently, very relaxed. And then if you really, really like this kind of meditation, it starts as a perception, as a way of looking, and then it becomes a feeling. You can focus on that loving feeling. You're generating this loving feeling for oneself, and you can use that as a meditation object. And you can develop some very, very good practice. You know, you can absorb into that feeling of love. You can sit there, you know, it might sound really, really weird, but, you know, you can sit there, you know, like loving yourself, and you can actually absorb into that feeling and really, you know, basically really get into it. But you can also do that with compassion. Compassion, the central formula is, may I be free from anxiety, worry, from some cancer which is ravishing my body. I could have some physical ailment. You know, may I be free from stress, from some kind of physical symptoms or whatnot. You use the power of the mind to actually affect the physical body, to affect the way you feel. So you know what the difficulty is. You know what's obstructing you. You focus very, very specifically on that. So, question three, Dituk from South Australia. Having listened to Dhamma talks and following Dhamma, I have cultivated many good qualities in myself. When I don't see such good qualities in other people now, I often feel frustrated, which didn't used to be the case before when I wasn't this good. Could you please... That's a good one. Could you please give me some advice to overcome this situation? So, you know, it's really nice to see that person is moving to a higher level and they can see the difference between themselves and the riffraff, so to speak. But you know, but some of us do feel that. We feel, you know, when we really feel that we're improving, there may even be a feelings of, say, pride and like elevated self-worth, and it could be quite genuine. You could genuinely be, you know, on the spiritual path, maybe superior to other people. It could be a reality principle, but there's an element of conceit there. You know, the Buddha, he never recommended that you think you are better than other people, you are worse than other people, you are the same as, because it's still a view, it's still a perspective. So what we're aiming for is a sense of like almost like non-attachment. You don't really... We some of us may do this, but if you start looking at other people, if you start comparing yourself with other people, it's going to create maybe a little bit of trouble for you, because it creates differences between you and other people. It separates you from other people. So it's better to be more open, have a kind of mind state which is like open and receptive. You don't have to love everyone. You don't have to feel compassion for everyone. But if you're open and receptive, you can listen, you can mix with people, you can understand people, at least to a small degree. You know, it's more than satisfactory. So what would I do? If I was in that person's shoes, I might be inclined to develop, say, equanimity, develop that very detached, maybe stable sense of mind. Or I would actually look at myself. Why do I think that I'm actually superior to other people? You know, even though I've been in the monastery for 20 years, it's quite funny, like, especially over the last couple of years, I really don't feel there's an incredible difference between myself and the lay practitioners. I've got this sense of, like, you know, we are human beings, you know, that these people, the lay practitioners, I'm a monk, I'm maybe superior or better to you, I've got more skill in meditation, and my wisdom faculty is greater. I don't feel that so much, not to any great degree. It seems to be more to this kind of openness to just a sense of say humankind. We're all human beings, so that's what I would probably do. And so we'll get back to is that Eddie in the back section? Yeah. You're right.
Ajahn Api, your talk, on applying mindfulness to our daily life experience.
Mm.
Okay, that is a very important practice for all Buddhists, and to look, be mindful of our daily life experience. Yeah, as I listened to your talk, my mind was recalling, the first verse of the Dhammapada, which stated, "The mind is the forerunner or creator of all states. Everything is mind-made." That's very powerful. That the things, yeah. So don't you think our mind, our mind and mindfulness of our mind and the resultant emotions and feelings, that's what the Buddha was saying, was asking us to look inwards to experience it. That's what he's telling us to do. You understand? Mindfulness, if you look at all this, the four foundations of mindfulness, Satipatthana is mindfulness, The Bhojangas too, the seven factors. First one is mindfulness. The Eightfold Path, the seventh one is right mindfulness. So that's a very important part. I think it's mindful of our mind and the resultant feeling, emotion, is that what he was asking us to look inwards for. What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You see what I mean? Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. That is the inward, that forms the basis of our inward experience. Did you get it?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's right, Eddie. You're on the ball. Okay. Were there any other customers? Anyone who's got an interesting opinion or challenging statement? Yeah, you can. If you get like really obvious lights in meditation. To give you an idea, this is a more intense experience. But one monk, I know of one monk who was meditating as he was dropping off to sleep. He went to sleep at about, it was after midnight, so roughly about 12:30 a.m. And then he just got like shocked awake at, it was like 2:30 in the morning. He had this kind of full body experience where he felt that he was like plugged into the universe. And what happened was he got this full rush of energy from the soles of the feet. It took about maybe about 5 seconds to reach the soles of the feet, to reach the actual head section. But when that energy moved up the body and up the spine and reached his mind exploded into this incredibly bright light, and there was so much energy there in that short experience. He couldn't get back to sleep, so he got up and then he sat for another 3 hours before he went up for the breakfast. And then that day he didn't have to have a nap after he went up. So he went from early morning, say roughly 2:30, and then he sat for over 3 hours. 5:30 went up for the morning work and the main meal, and he was still so energized. There was no nap in the afternoon, and then he went right back late, probably till about maybe 11 p.m. before he dropped off to sleep that second cycle. Yeah, well, you know, because the thing is, if you get some tranquility or samadhi, some people can get mental phenomena inside the mind. Or they could get the samadhi nimitta, which they could get like a flash of light for maybe even 1 or 2 or 3 seconds as possible. You can have like mind phenomena. You can have energies in the mind. You can have a genuine samadhi nimitta. There's two possibilities. Are there any other takers? Okay, so we'll call it an evening if you like. Just pay our respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.